I'm going to leave.
House Labor and Commerce will now come to orders, 317, lucky number. March 11th, and with us are Representative Holmes, Representative Chenault, Representative Book, and myself, Chair Olson. We have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones, Blackberries, whatever. First item on the agenda is House Bill 29. Do we want to take a brief of these and...
Yep.
Which one?
Brief of these?
Brief of these? Which one are we bringing?
Bring up Jennifer Sinnett. The public testimony has been closed, so this will be committee comments, and I think we have at least one committee member with a question.
You do, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Sinnett, staff to the Chair, Representative Olson. Can I start right in on
Welcome
the...
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go ahead and ask, although I think Jennifer knows what my question is. For the benefit of the record, I'll ask the question first. It occurred to me that we have a federal minimum wage and a state minimum wage, and we've spent a lot of time talking about the interaction between the two and which one's higher and which one's lower. And I realize there's a fairly basic question I don't know, which is, do both minimum wages apply to all employers in the state of Alaska, or are there certain that are, and you have to pay the higher of the two, or are there certain employers within the state that are exempted from one or the other, and how does that interaction work?
Before you answer, I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Lynn.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Through the Chair, Representative Holmes, you are correct. It is the higher of the two. Obviously, some states have a higher minimum wage than the federal level. So in these instances, if an employee is covered, if an employee is covered by both the state and the federal minimum wage, he would be entitled to the higher of the two. So that's why, obviously, in July, even without the passage of an Alaskan minimum wage bill, that an employee working at the Alaska minimum would be entitled to a higher wage come July. The federal minimum wage law, the FLSA, that applies to employees of enterprises that have an annual gross volume and sales of over $500,000, and it also applies to employees of smaller firms that are involved in interstate commerce or that are producing goods to be used for commerce. There are exceptions to this. There are exceptions to the federal minimum wage law, and those exceptions basically, in general, line up very well with the exceptions that that we have in the Alaska state minimum wage law. And these are really broad exceptions, like for farmers working in agriculture, for fishermen. And then there are some narrower exceptions that are only found, say, in the federal law. Like there's an exception for wreath makers who work at home in the federal law, which we don't have at the at the state level. Talking to the Department of Labor contacts here, there is a little bit of confusion with the U.S. Department of Labor. The enforcement interpretations and policies at the U.S. Department are kind of in flux right now, and so it's difficult to tell exactly who is going to be exempt from the federal level and who is exempt at the state level. Obviously, if this bill would continue on, I'll be in further contact with people at the U.S. Department of Labor to get that little better ironed out. But at this point, it just looks like their enforcement policies are a bit in flux right now, so it's kind of hard to give you an exact answer to the people that would be covered under one but not the other.
But Mr. Chairman, if I follow up, it's pretty safe to say that would be a pretty small universe, and that the vast majority of people working in the state would be covered under would be the higher, whichever one's higher.
Representative Holm, through the chair, that is correct. The exemptions that aren't if the federal has one exemption that the state doesn't have, typically these are very narrow, like I mentioned before, like wreath makers. So that would be a relatively small number in proportion to the workforce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was very helpful to me, especially in light of the amendment that I think is going to be coming, just trying to figure out. Originally, the bill was, both were expected to go up at the same time, so it wasn't as relevant. But with the amendment I expect to be presented shortly, all of a sudden I realized I needed a little bit more guidance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Sinnet? I think we'll hopefully take what is a 1 or 2 minute brief at ease. We've closed out public testimony. We have Jennifer Sinnet from my staff, and it's open to committee comments. And I believe there's, and we've been joined by Representative John Coghill, who I think has some comments. But first, I wonder if I could get somebody to move amendment number one.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
And then I'll object for purposes of discussion.
See the amendment.
Jennifer, amendment number one.
All right, so I'll just speak briefly to the amendment here. As you know, if you have it in front of you, it's pretty straightforward and brief. As I've said a few times, throughout this process, we've been hearing from people from all over the state. And this amendment really takes into account a lot of the feedback that we have been hearing. What this amendment does is it basically makes the legislation a bit easier to swallow for business owners, and it does that in two ways. First, it gives businesses sufficient time to budget for the changes. You know, without the amendment, businesses would be going into this rate hike without having taken this into account, and obviously that that's a big stress on businesses. And so the second way that it helps people out is the moving the date from July to January ensures that business owners, they don't have to hike up their wages in the middle of summer, which I think, you know, as we all know, that's a key time for Alaskan businesses is in the summer. So that's it's kind of the impetus for putting it back into January. So those are major concerns that we've been hearing, and we feel that this amendment adequately addresses them.
Well, I'll lift my objection to amendment number one. Is there any further discussion of amendment number one? Is there any further objection? Then we'll adopt amendment number one, which is /A.3. And that will bring the bill back before us. And I know there's some discussion on that. Representative Coghill.
You're reading my mind, Mr. Chairman.
I'm just telepathic.
Well, I did not prepare an amendment, knowing your rule here, I'm just going to make the statement, and I won't try to hold the bill up because we do have other committees. But, Mr. Chairman, I agree with trying to tier this in and at the minimum finding some equity with not only the timing of the federal law but the timing of our industry. But I also think that I've never been a big fan of minimum wages to begin with. But if we're going to go down this road, I think we ought to go a little slower. So I'm going to suggest somewhere along the line that instead of the 50 cents, we shave that back probably half to 25 cents. Because I can't see past the curve of this downturn economy just yet. And I think that we need to exercise some degree of caution on this. And so... I'm not going to try to hold the bill up here, but I'm just going to express it here in the committee. I think that we need to express some caution.
But I'd like to make one comment, I think, as the the sponsor of the bill, and that's that I've had nobody call in that has liked this bill. Everybody has disliked it for basically two reasons, not enough or it's too much. But with that, we've had 50 cents for a lengthy period of time, and I personally don't think it's unreasonable. I choked on inflation proofing it. I choked on some of the other things that are in other versions of this bill. I'm not happy with this bill, so I guess I'm like everybody else who's called in to testify on it. But I think it's a reasonable bill. And Representative Book?
Aye.
Oh, you don't have a question?
I'm just listening.
Any further questions?
Chairman, it wouldn't be my intention to hold up the bill, so if you want a motion to move it, I can do that.
Seeing no opposition.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill 29. It's the version A that we're working off of as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, and it does go to Finance Committee, if I remember. Yes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief please. Today will be House Bill 175. It's my intention not to move the bill today, but to have Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance walk us through this bill, and then I think it's going to take a couple days at least to digest it. But please join us, Ms. Hall.
Insurance, 175.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. I know I shut that off.
Don't want to buy us bagels?
No, thank you very much. Well, I shut it off. I don't know what's wrong.
You phoned a friend?
Phoned a friend.
Yeah, lifeline?
Whatever lifeline.
You guys want bagels?
Just leave it on. We can call it.
This is not a good start. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am here today to do the introduction to the bill you've all been waiting for.
Do we call it the mega bill or the omnibus bill?
No,
or
you've never heard me use that term, Mr. Chairman.
It's not a small bill, is it? Simple?
It's both. It is a small bill, and it's simple. When I get done, you'll understand it all.
No doubt.
I am going to apologize to begin with, just for you, that it does have a very long title. Last week, we had a heated discussion between Ledge Drafting and my legal counsel over the title. And Ledge Drafting won, and his comments to me were, nobody ever reads the insurance bills, so we think the title should be more inclusive. So, the title has more things in it, and it's long. That was not my request.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I actually read the bill last night.
Through the chair, thank you very much, Representative Holmes. On a more serious note, I would like to start. Your time is valuable. This bill has various changes to the insurance statute that we continue to strive for efficient regulation. And I want to talk about three areas in general that are important, and I think in today's economy and with some of the news, you would recognize the importance of, first and foremost, our solvency oversight. That's the first thing we do, is regulate for solvency. We are watching continually and participating almost weekly in national calls with our counterparts around the country, dealing with major issues such as AIG, as I'm sure you would imagine we are. I have concerns for the most part. I think right now the insurance industry is still strong and stable. The property casualty industry, there are some concerns in the life insurance industry. I think those are still stable. We have, as recently as today, however, insurance companies and producers making statements about the guarantees the state provides for life insurance and annuities. That one violates laws, and I did bulletins in the fall, and apparently I need to do them again. One, the state does not guarantee life insurance policies or annuities, and two, you cannot make these statements. We personally delivered letters to that effect to some offenders last year, and we'll do so again. Secondly, our mission is consumer protection. And as we look at our marketplace, we look at consumer protection as a major function of what we do. I've been before you before. We have four consumer service people whose total job is to deal with consumers, to interact between consumers and insurance companies. We have four fraud investigators. They are legal. They look at legal issues. They all have law enforcement background. And so we look at fraud. And thirdly, we look at a healthy competitive marketplace. Alaska is a very small market. It's difficult to attract insurance companies here. I firmly believe today, as I have for years, the best consumer protection we have is choice. And we need a choice of insurance companies in order to have good, healthy marketplace. It's difficult when we're this size.
Linda, you have your first question, I believe, Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might interrupt, I hate to disrupt your thought pattern, but you alluded to something that, as far as enforcement is concerned, you said you delivered letters. Now, and then you also just brought up fraud. So is there some ground here that some of these companies are treading, a line that they're stepping across? Is there perhaps some enforcement that isn't being caretaken for to align their interest with ours?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I did mention fraud, and I'm going to actually talk about fraud a little bit later in my presentation. There's a piece, and they're really, what we're seeing today isn't fraud. It's, I believe, although I will know more when I track down I don't know who said it at this point. I did know before, and we did not consider it fraud. We certainly enforce fraudulent actions. We have a criminal prosecutor, and we use that mechanism very regularly. We have generally stipulated agreements. We have negotiated agreements, and right now which I will talk about later, I'm waiting for somebody to end up in jail for insurance fraud. So it's not something we do lightly or steps that we're not taking. It is more a matter of you have to make sure they understand that because the guarantee fund is in our statute, doesn't meet the state guarantees the payment of claims through that guarantee fund.
Ms. Follow-up. Thank you. Could you speak to the deterrence of such activity should there be the penalties? If there is punitive action and penalties and a fiscal recovery there, where does that money go?
Penalties and fines go to the general fund.
Thank you.
Through the chair. I'm sorry. I forget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have in this bill, which is 23 pages long, 8 pages of it deal with insolvency, and that is a section that I will spend some time talking about. So quickly, I have 3 areas that I am not doing this necessarily in the order of the bill. What I've tried to do is put together in groupings the things that we're trying to do here. One is to streamline processes both for the Division of Insurance and for the industry people. 2 is to clarify provisions in the statute, and 3 is to be more in compliance with national standards. The sections that deal with streamlining processes are Section 10, and I would be happy to discuss them in detail if you'd like. I'm planning just to do a little summary. Section 10 allows us to license a non-resident adjuster whose state of residence does not license adjusters. Most of our non-resident licensing is dependent on a concept of home state. If you reside in Alaska and you have an insurance license to be an agent, an adjuster, an MGA, whatever you may be, I'm sorry, I try not to use acronyms, you can go to another state, and based on the fact that you're licensed here, you are granted basically reciprocity. We have some states in the country that do not license independent insurance adjusters. This provision allows us to license them so they can adjust claims in Alaska. We have a shortage of adjusters, and we want to make sure there are adequate adjusters should we have need for more adjusters to make sure we are efficiently and timely handling claims of insurance companies.
So that means that right now there's no process by which if you have somebody who's comes from a state that doesn't license them and they show up here, there's no way currently for us to do that, and this kind of provides a way for us to allow them to do business here. Is that it?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, yes. Okay. It allows us to do a type of reciprocity. We can license them as if this were their home state.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Section 12 is a simplification that when we have third-party administrators, they're frequently out of state, they do not have to register all of their employees. Third-party administrators are not licensed. They go through a registration process that is a little bit less onerous than full licensing. And their employees, they may have a lot of employees, say they're a call center in Dubuque, Iowa. And this way they only have to register the firm, and they agree to be responsible for all of their employees. So there's still an accountability piece, but it streamlines that process. And Section 18 allows the director to accept another regulator's evaluation of a non-resident with a felony conviction. Under federal law, to participate in the business of insurance, one must have the approval of the regulator. If you have a felony conviction, that is for dishonesty or breach of trust. And it's called a 1033 application. Today, we have to do the full evaluation for every non-resident that applies. Not that there are a lot of them, but this will allow us to accept the regulator's evaluation from the home state and to treat that as reciprocal. I am going to mention something I'm very proud of. Tomorrow will be for the first time in this whole category of streamlining processes, although it's not in this bill. We turn on electronic resident licensing tomorrow. We have been electronically licensing non-residents for 2 years, but the licensing for residents in each state, because that is the primary regulator, is much more difficult, and tomorrow our residents will be able to start applying electronically for licenses, which is a very exciting step for us. I have several things I could brag about. Second area, very quickly, clarity of provisions. Sections 5 and 6 deal with deposits. Insurance companies make deposits in our state, and this clarifies and makes a difference between a domestic insurer, those are the ones that are actually, we are the primary regulators for. It will allow us some additional flexibility to work with our domestic insurers. And Section 6 deals with insurers who are domiciled in other states. Again, these are insurers who are in insolvency. You'll hear that word several times as I go through the bill. Much of our insolvency rehabilitation regulation has not been changed since 1990. Originally, before the session began, we had a proposal to totally redo, it's actually Chapter 78, and this bill is 23 pages. The estimate was that bill will be 200 pages, so we aren't doing it right now. But our
thank you.
It makes this look good.
Something to look forward to next year, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we are working on it, but it's a major project. But our ability to update statutes is important, and we have not updated our rehabilitation and liquidation statutes for a very long time. And we need to do some of that. So there were a couple provisions we felt were critical when we were not doing the 200-page bill. So we do have them in this bill. So you'll hear me talk about that. And in today's world, I think it's very important that we talk about our tools to regulate for solvency. So we've clarified deposits for our insurers, and seemingly simple thing, we have also defined working day uniformly throughout the title. We had various definitions of working day, and in this version, they'll all be the same. That's Section 31.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I can ask a...
Certainly.
And it looks like that these sections are giving you a little bit more flexibility to deal with these without having to go through a court. Is that sort of an accurate...
It would give us, for our domestic insurers, a little more flexibility because we're not using the term insolvency. We're talking about delinquency proceedings for domestic regulators, so we can work with them. And insolvency clearly goes through a court, and most of these proceedings do require court orders. But it would give us some ability to work with a domestic insurer in rehabilitation. And that's really what we're looking for. We want to make sure that our domestic insurers have proper oversight, but that we also try to make sure they succeed. We want them to be able to pay claims, and if they go into true liquidation, then the ability to have claims paid sometimes comes into question. They're rarely paid at 100 cents on the dollar. The two sections that deal with uniformity are sections 8 and 9, fairly simple things. We have a person called a compliance officer in a firm who makes sure that that firm license, that firm agency, we would call them agencies usually, complies with all of our statutes. There's a responsible party. And that was my second brag for the day. I'm going to show you a chart. You can't read it. You don't want to. But you see all these X's down here? That's the section that says Alaska's compliant. Very few states have achieved that. We just received that yesterday, that we are now compliant with all of the national uniform standards. We've worked hard to be in compliance with those, and we finally achieved that. So we have a compliance officer, and they do not have to be licensed for all lines of authority, but they do have to be licensed. And Section 9 just updates our limited travel lines license. We do regulate travel insurance, among some of the other unusual things we regulate. The last part will take me a little bit longer, and I will try to be brief, are new issues. And I would draw your attention first to Section 11. This is new, and it's something I feel very strongly about. I hope you agree. It's a new section that would give the director the ability to do a summary suspension of an agent's license. If, and there are a lot of restrictions around this, finds that protection of the public requires emergency action and incorporates that finding in an order. The licensee can request a hearing. The hearing has to take place within 20 days. Decision has to be issued within 30 days. This particular proceeding would not be under the Office of Administrative Hearings. I'm going to give you the reason we're looking for this. This is not something that would be used very often, but we had two instances this fall. I mentioned earlier I was going to talk about fraud. In the fall, we had a consumer complaint. They had purchased insurance and hadn't received an insurance policy, and it went to my fraud investigators. As they started looking at this, we had an insurance agent who had collected money, not placed insurance. The particular one we started with was a premium of about $27,000. It ranged from a few hundred dollars to several thousand dollars. We had 72 victims of fraud. Our criminal prosecutor has drawn up criminal charges with 39 felony counts. This individual could still have a license. In this particular case, the license was voluntarily surrendered. But had it not been voluntarily surrendered, if we had done an order suspending the license, that order is stayed by the request of a hearing. And I think it's critical that we do not allow someone who has exhibited that kind of behavior to maintain the ability to transact insurance. So this is new, and I sometimes feel like it's maybe inappropriate, but I'm really looking at jail time for this individual.
Representative Book.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. under Section 11, in this section in the bill, the guidelines by which you, in this summary decision, are they outlined in that? I didn't get a chance to go through this bill, but is there a description of that in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Book, yes, there are reasons. One, obviously, is the emergency action and the hearing, but it has to be based on the grounds that are in our licensing title. So the grounds for which we can do this are described in our title already. This is just the ability to do it immediately and take the license away and not be stayed by the request of a hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you were saying earlier that it's not covered by the administrative hearing. It's covered by a separate hearing structure that's laid out elsewhere. Is that what I just wanted to say?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, it is through the hearing process in Title 21. We have a formal hearing process. I can give you an example. Yesterday, I was in Anchorage serving as a hearing officer. and a hearing that was an appeal of a decision that comes to the director. We have a very specific process that actually supersedes the Office of Administrative Hearings because we have very specific hearings. Only some of our matters, our appeals, actually go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The others are done internally. So we have all of the notice of rights, all of the various due process things that you would find in the Office of Administrative Hearings.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up, you hit on precisely where I think my concern is going to be on this section, which is making 100% sure that we, and I know you, and I know you've done your homework, but just satisfying myself that that this is not going to get us in any trouble with due process rights, and we don't end up having having you suspend somebody who really needs to be suspended, have it thrown out because the court decides that this doesn't comply with due process. So I'm just going to be looking at that as we go forward, just to be sure.
Is that a question?
Not really.
Okay,
just a heads up.
And that's fine. And and through the chair, Representative Holmes, that certainly is something I'm very aware of, and it's part of the reason I specifically ask you to look at the section. I pointed out the language because it is something that I think deserves discussion. It has, as you might imagine, thorough legal review on a variety of levels, both from my AAGs, from the Department of Law, and from Ledge Legal. It's gone through all of those, and I am not, and the OAH has also looked at it and signed off on it. So, I mean, we have done those various kinds of things because this is new and it's serious, but the behavior is serious. I had two of these instances this fall. The other one was reported by an employer. The individual employee had taken premium funds out of the safe not only once but twice. And the employer brought him to our office to surrender his license. But, again, we have some serious behavior that we need to make sure those people are not allowed to continue transacting insurance while we're in the process. I feel that strongly. We have 72 victims of fraud, and there's no money for restitution. It's very difficult for me to get a call from one of those 72 people, well, where do I get my money back? And there is no place you get your money back. You can sue, but highly unlikely. Insurance companies, we also have a statute that says payment to the agent is payment to the company. And so we had a number of insurance companies who actually issued insurance policies for which they did not receive money because of that provision. And here again, I got a call. We've hired local counsel. What do you think our chances of recouping some of this money are? To which my response was somewhere between zero and none. So, I mean, these are things that are very, very infrequent, but I think we want the tools to deal with those infrequent things because they severely impact consumers. Luckily, there were no losses from lack of having a policy during this period of time.
Representative Booth.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Director Hall, you mentioned a couple of ways by which this information came to you. One was a complaint, the other was the employer. These are sort of after-the-fact kinds of things that occur, I'm sure, over time. Do you have investigators that are out there actively pursuing caretaking for the consumers in this state?
Through the chair, Representative Book, we have almost 40,000 licensed agents in the state. We have 2,000 insurance companies that do business here. We have a variety of checking mechanisms, but we certainly don't have the resources to check every agency. We are in the process today of doing an audit of an agency. We will do financial audits of agencies. We have statutory requirements, and we do audits of our domestic insurers. Once every 3 years, we look at filed financial statements of every company that does business here. Both of these are agent fraud, and it's very difficult for us to know what every agency is doing, and we would just never have the resources to go out and audit every one of them. So it's not unusual for us to have things through the complaint process, or an employer, we do have statutes that require insurance companies to report suspected fraud. We have statutes that would require an insurance agent to report fraud, but they aren't going to turn themselves in.
Paul? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Hall, since 1990, has this industry been burgeoning? I mean, have we been growing in numbers of agencies and agents? And I mean, has this been something of a trend whereby the insurance industry has been growing to the extent outside of other industries regarding the kinds of things that consumers would be dealing in? I'm just trying to look at, you know, in the last 18 years, where we've gone, if we've gone to a situation where we have sort of lost control of even keeping track of, you know, the size, the industry, and the availability for you to do your job.
Through the chair, Representative Book, I guess I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. I can tell you when I started in early 2003, we had 14, a little over 14,000 licensed agents. Today we have almost 40,000. We have that kind of growth. We have probably roughly the same number of insurance companies. It may change in who they are. There's a dramatic difference in the number of licensed companies who do business here versus the number who actively solicit and write business. The majority of those 40,000 agents are non-residents, so their primary regulator is elsewhere. Probably 4,000 of them are residents. Has it grown where we can't keep track? I truly don't think so. You know, we have a license and a renewal, and we monitor that in a variety of ways. Resources, that's a different issue. Budgets, various kinds of, that I'm not going to go into, and here it's not really the place to do that.
Paul, I didn't mean to get into that territory, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering if this is an anomaly here. We've got a 5 times growth in 4 years. In many of the other industries, we're compressing, and industries are shrinking. So it's kind of where one industry has grown by leaps and bounds, and we have some of the rest of industry that is absolutely suffering. So it's kind of eye-opening to me to see this kind of a trend. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I comment? I understand. Through the chair, Representative Book, one of the reasons for this trend is the requirement that, for example, people who sell and solicit insurance who work for insurance companies now have to be licensed. We have call centers. I'm going to use I hate to use examples, but I'm going to use Safeco, for example. Safeco has call centers, and they take consumer complaints. They take sales calls. It used to be that those individuals didn't have to be licensed at all. So there was no real oversight, not any regulatory oversight. Today they have to be licensed, and that is, in my estimation, much of the reason for the growth in the number of licensees. There are still people we're tracking, but it's that kind of thing. It's not that we have 40,000 people in Alaska selling insurance, but it are people who may interact. Two of them may be assigned to Alaska. They license all 40 of them on the off chance that somebody will take a call who's not licensed. And we do follow up on those. And we have found people not licensed, and we've taken action.
One more? just a comment, Mr. Chairman. That's basically what I needed to know. You've told me that basically because of the requirement for licensing, then maybe the real issue is that there was people out there that we weren't aware of and didn't have oversight of, and so maybe the numbers hasn't grown to that point. It's just a matter of that now we're tracking who is doing what.
Through the chair, Representative Book, I think that's true. Some of them are non-resident. Let me give you another example that's local. And it probably will surprise you that if you work in an auto dealership and sell a policy called a guaranteed auto protection, it's the difference between what you owe on your car and what you can sell it for. You have to have an insurance license to do that. Many of the people in that industry were unaware that they needed to be licensed, and we spent 2 years trying to do an education, and it's not ever, and it was not then, my intent to be punitive. My real goal is compliance, and we worked with an association, and we now have the majority of those people are licensed, but some of that is an education and making sure the people who are transacting business really are licensed to do so, and there is some oversight of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, I'm going to ask for a simple request. Can you give the committee an idea on how much premium tax the division generates in 1 year? To give them, it might help them have a better handle on the scope of your activities.
I saw figures yesterday from, I have a premium tax auditor through the, oh, you are the chair. Sorry. Now, this is really bad. Mr. Chairman, just yesterday I saw a request from the Department of Revenue to our tax auditor, and we do have a tax auditor. We do audits of surplus lines brokers for taxes and of insurance companies. They do premium tax reports. They were just due March 1st. Based on the 2008 premium tax, the estimate for 2009 is roughly $50 million in premium tax. A portion of that goes directly to fund the Division of Workers' Compensation. Part of the premium tax on workers' compensation insurance is transmitted to fund, as I said, the Division of Workers' Compensation. But right now, the estimate for FY09 is roughly $50 million. That does not include the fees that we collect for regulating entities. We collect roughly $10 million in fees, various types of fees that we collect from insurance companies, from agents, from various kinds of entities. So generally as an agency, we bring in, I would guess in FY09, we would bring in the range of $60 million, and that's before I fine anybody, Representative Book.
The point I was trying to make with that and leading Ms. Hall was the fact that she generates a significant amount of money to the general fund. She doesn't spend it all.
We are a receipts-based agency, so we are not funded by general funds at all, and that's why I emphasize that the fines we collect do go to the general fund, not to us.
Didn't mean to sidetrack you.
That's quite all right. I think it's an important point. We are generally in the top three or four sources of revenue to the general fund. Now, obviously a long way from number one, but but we're still fairly significant.
I believe the term is a cash cow, but
I would not say that. I was waiting for somebody to ask me what my budget is out of all that money. But
Mr. Chairman, can we ask her what her budget is out of all that money?
Certainly.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. But through the chair, Representative Holmes, it's like $6.9 million out of that. To go on. Another new issue. After we've talked about summary suspension, Section 17 is a provision that goes along with some of the concerns about the cost of health insurance. It's a regular complaint. Probably the top complaint we get in our office deals with health insurance, either how much it costs or how little people get paid. And we deal with both ends of that on a regular basis. Section 17 has a provision that will allow a wellness program has to follow the federal HIPAA requirements to make sure that we're not doing discrimination. But this is put in our trade practices section So that is not considered rebating, but it will allow a health care provider to offer some types of rewards for wellness programs, to encourage wellness programs, the hope being that those will ultimately, it's long-term, reduce the amount of health claims and thus health insurance premiums.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For those of us who are new to the committee, can you explain to me what the ramifications would be for something? I mean, what does it mean that it's not considered a rebate program? What does that mean to them, to us?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, a rebate is something that is given as an inducement to buy insurance, okay, or it is an unfairly discriminatory premium. I gave you a lower premium for insurance than I gave Representative Book. Mm-hmm. When you have the same risk characteristics, that's considered rebating. We have lengthy rebating, okay, statutes, and this would be giving someone a different premium. Mm-hmm. You might get a premium because you participated in a walking program of so many miles, and your employer then got a 50% of the employees do this, and you get a 5% credit on your premium. Okay. Representative Book doesn't get that credit because he doesn't walk. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to pick on you. But
And so, Mr. Chairman, so this basically makes it clear that that's okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's correct.
That was helpful.
That's true, Anna Bombs.
Section 24 is something fairly minor, but I think it's important. It establishes the eligibility for the high-risk pool, so it's the same eligibility requirements as the permanent fund dividend eligibility. Sections 25 and 26 are probably these are pages 15 to 20, that if part of this, if the rest of this insurance bill is complicated, this is even more so. And I am going to give you some definitions. I'll try to make them clear, and I'll try to be concise. These are the pieces of the rehabilitation that we have added to this particular bill. As I indicated earlier, the chapter has not been updated since 1990. It did not address the type of policy we're addressing here. We need to assure that if we have a liquidation, that we are adequately able to address a particular kind of policy, and we need to address today what's called early access to funds, and I will talk about both of those. The Section 25 merely is a reiteration of the priority that claims are paid in what is the insurance equivalent of a bankruptcy. Insurance companies are not put in bankruptcy. They are put in liquidation with a receiver. Traditionally, the director of insurance in this state would be the receiver. I am currently the receiver on an estate of an insurer. And these are the priorities. The only thing that's changed here is an exception in the very first line for the kind of policy I'm going to talk about. So they're really, we have like two pages that aren't anything new. When we get to Section 26, we're talking about something that's called a loss reimbursement policy. This is something that is like a large deductible policy that the policyholder agrees to pay back the insurer for that large deductible. The example I would use that probably is the easiest to understand is a workers' compensation policy. Under the workers' compensation statutes, the insurance company has to pay first dollar claims. So when we have an insured with a large deductible, and we don't normally have deductibles in work comp, but we have, they're called retentions when they're big, like $100,000. I'm going to retain $100,000 of the risk of my workers' compensation claims. The insurance company still has to pay from dollar one. So the injured worker is assured of getting their money from the insurance company. The insurance company is going to expect me, under this form, to pay them back that $100,000. That is not today addressed in statute of how that $100,000 that I owe that insurance company, I wouldn't owe it all in one lump sum necessarily, but how is that going to be treated in the case of a liquidation? This goes through about four pages, and five, of how that will happen. It guarantees that the employer who has that reimbursement obligation still has it. It's not taken away in insolvency. Their collateral, and frequently there's collateral for that, insurance companies aren't necessarily going to offer to let me just owe them $100,000. So there may be a letter of credit there. That's usually what the collateral is. It may be a cash deposit. I have someone in Alaska who has a cash deposit in another state of $6 million in a bankrupt company, and they don't quite know how to get their money back. And this addresses that for our state. The collateral can be tapped by either the receiver or the guarantee fund. The guarantee fund would take over paying the claim on behalf of that insolvent insurer. So you could have the employer, in the case I'm using, owe the guarantee fund. We want the guarantee fund to be able to collect that money. So that's basically what this loss reimbursement section is about. And, you know, if you want me to explain in more detail, I'd be happy to, but I don't want to, you know, go overboard.
Representative Booth.
I'm looking for numbers here through the chair. In your experience, let's put it in your experience, how many of these insurance companies in insolvencies have you seen?
I've seen none of a domestic insurer, a one that we regulate.
Okay.
But in 2003, we had an insolvency of Fremont.
Right.
And that was a work comp insurer. It was an appalling thing. Our guarantee fund didn't have the money to pay claims. I mean, that's why I want to make sure today we have the ability to address things that we don't have the ability to address. This didn't happen in that case. It didn't become an issue. But just given the general financial environment today, I think we need to be prepared for some of these things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions about that piece of this? The other piece is called, and it's on page 19, it's still in this section, early access distributions. The biggest reason we made it through that 2003 crisis in 2004 when our guarantee fund did not have adequate money was because other states gave us what are called early access distributions. From the estate of the insolvent insurer, Fremont, Reliance started to make distributions of money if there were adequate assets. They did, with the approval of a court, it has to be filed with a court, they gave funds to our guarantee fund, so that was part of the way they got enough money to pay claims. This particular piece of this legislation requires a receiver to apply to the court to make these payments. We don't have that requirement today, and again, I think it's important that we have the mechanisms for our guarantee funds to get money in the case of insolvent insurers. So that's the second part of this piece that I think is updating our rehabilitation liquidation statutes. I'm just waiting.
You're on a roll, Linda.
I'm on a roll. Okay. I'm almost done. I'm sorry. The other two new things, one is Sections 28, merely requires the deposit, the administration of deposits chapter to apply to self-funded health care entities, better known as multiple employer welfare arrangements. I hate to even use that term. Mm-hmm. MEWAs. And Section 30, we have added two things to the Hospital and Medical Service Corporation. One, making the statutes that have to do with representations on an application apply to these entities, and two, the guaranteed renewability of individual health care insurance, making that applicable. That is a federal law also, but we want it in our statutes. And with that, I'm at the end of this very long bill. There are some repealers and things like that.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question mark next to section 22.
22.
And I think we kind of, I don't think we stopped very long on that one. It's the...
What page?
Page 12, line 23. It deals with supplemental plans for Medicare, and basically it seems to be the only substantive change is from a shall to a may. I was just wondering if you could
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, it is a little more than that. This applies to the high-risk plan, who currently offer an expanded care to Medicare-eligible people that is probably broader coverage than a medical supplement plan would be. So it would give them the flexibility to either offer a medical supplement policy or what they currently offer, which is actually a little broader. It's just to allow the high-risk plan to have a little more flexibility in the plan they offer.
So
that's why the change from may to shall is to give them flexibility.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so the intention of this is not to reduce the number of plans or the options available to Medicare. That's because I'm not reading this in context of the rest of the statute, and so I just wanted to make sure that we're not reducing. I know we're having a hard time with Medicare coverage in this state, and I just wanted to make sure that this section isn't in any way reducing options to Medicare eligible individuals.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, absolutely not. This Chapter 55 is strictly the high risk. It's called the state plan, which I've never quite figured out, but that is the high-risk pool. It's the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, CHIA.
We like acronyms. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Ms. Hall? Representative Booth.
Director Hall, do you have insomnia? Is this what you do night and day?
Through the chair, usually, yes, I do.
I was just wondering. Thank you, sir.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you.
It's not my intent to do anything with the bill today. I think everybody's going to need a couple days to digest it, including the insurance companies, the consumer groups. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on the bill today?
Could I make one final statement, Mr. Chairman?
Two or three.
I just will also offer, if you have questions that you would like to talk to me or to one of my staff who are real experts in the various sections that I just pulled together, please don't hesitate to call me. This is probably the first hearing I have done in 6 years that I did not visit with committee members prior to the hearing. And I would be more than happy to do that.
And Mr. Chairman, I already have seen her on my schedule, which is part of why I'm for later in the week.
Any further questions for Ms. Hall? Thanks
Thank
again.
You.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify? And I don't believe there's anybody online, so we're gonna hold the public testimony open, and we're gonna carry it over to either Friday or Monday. And with that, we're gonna move on to a couple of painless bills.
No such thing.
Oh, yes, there is.
Thank you.
We got a couple of sunsets. First one is House Bill 78, extending the Board of Public Accountancy. Do we have anybody online that's heard me?
Yes.
Not yet.
Sorry.
Thank you. Just checking. Conrad Jackson of my staff is carrying the bill, and for the record, identify yourself. And
Okay. I thought you said Conrad. Is Conrad?
Yep, Conrad Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record,
Comrade. Yeah.
That's what I thought you said. What committee am I on here?
For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Before the committee today, we've got a couple more sunset extensions. The bill before us now, House Bill 78, is the extension of the Board of Public Accountancy. As is the case with all boards approaching their sunset date, they're reviewed, audited by the Legislative Audit Division. And in this case, they've made a couple of recommendations, one of which is the whole thrust of this, an extension of their sunset date to 2013. It extends that board 4 years. And at that point, they would come back before the legislature, and hopefully you would be extending them again. As before, we've got Pat Davidson from Legislative Budget and Audit here to answer any specific questions or address the other recommendations that the audit was made.
Pat, why don't you come up? Thanks, Conrad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. The Board of Public Accountancy if you have a copy of the report and you're looking at it, it looks a little different. It actually wasn't published. We actually contracted this board out to a consultant. The reason is, under professional auditing standards, we need to be independent of the organizations that we audit. Since my office is staffed with either CPAs or CPA wannabes, we are not independent with regard to this board. Therefore, using the criteria in statute to identify the areas that needed to be analyzed for public need, we hired a consultant to come in, also a non-CPA, to come in and do the review. As Mr. Jackson indicated, the recommendation is a four-year extension. The reason being there's probable substantial statutory and regulatory changes with the Board of Accountancy. They are doing some things to change how they operate and they do business, involving less action by the board, more action by the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. Therefore, we recommended a shorter extension period so that as they go through that process, we can come back, look at them, make sure that the public interest is still being served. The specific recommendations in this report are three. First, they need to have their vacancies on their board filled in a timely manner. Secondly, we took a look at the fees being charged. These boards are financially self-supporting. What we found was a surplus was growing with regard to this board. We made a recommendation that fees be reduced. And the third one is that as we looked at the investigative efforts by the Division of Professional Licensing, we saw that there were periods of inactivity on some of the investigations, and basically the tracking mechanism associated with their investigative software isn't very good. They really do need to update that case management so that they stay on top of their open investigations. And with that, if there's any questions.
Any questions for Pat? Do we have anybody in the room that cares to testify on the bill? We'll go to the public. We have nobody online other than a question only from Kathleen Reed. Kathleen, do you have anything to add, or are you just questions?
Thank you, Mr. I guess it's my turn to say something now. This is Kathleen Reed, Public Board of Accountancy, and I'm just here if you have any questions for the board.
Oh, well, thanks for hanging on and being with us.
Apologize for interrupting earlier.
And seeing nobody else online, and we're going to close it out to public testimony. What's the will of the committee?
Would you entertain a motion, Mr. Chair?
I certainly will.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill number 78, 26-LS0387/A, the individual recommendations. Is there a fiscal note here? Mm-hmm. There is or is not? There's no fiscal note, is there?
Yes, there is.
Yes.
With attached fiscal note.
Yep. Seeing no opposition, we'll move the House Bill 78 out of committee and take a brief at ease. The sunset extension on the veterinarian board.
Which one?
86, House Bill 86, be carried by Conrad Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Before the committee, House Bill 86, which extends the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Basically take everything that was said with the last bill and change the name and the number. The difference in this bill is the recommended extension time or extension period for this board will be 8 years, would extend the sunset to June 30th, 2017. And again, Ms. Davidson is with us to walk you through any particular details you may have questions on.
Please join us, Pat. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit, still. We found that the Board of Veterinary Examiners is serving a public purpose in terms of the mission that they do. We believe that the board should be extended until June 30, 2017. Two of the recommendations, as Mr. Jackson alluded, are basically the same as the Board of Accountancy. A little different in detail, but generally the same. First, vacancies on the board need to be filled in a more timely manner. These are volunteer boards. It's very important to have membership on the board filled so that, you know, the board's work can be carried on without, you know, taxing too few people with too many responsibilities. Secondly, additionally, on the financial side, a surplus has been growing with regard to this board, and therefore fees should be reduced.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The common theme of filling the positions more quickly, is that are those people who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature, are those the positions that are not being filled in a timely manner?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, yes, they are.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Booth.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Just checking. Well, is everybody, I think we'll go to the public now. Thanks. Thanks again, Pat. Seeing nobody in the public here, we do have somebody online, and we'll go to Dr. Tim Bowser. How you doing, Tim?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Welcome to Labor and Commerce. What's the weather like at home?
Oh, it's just mild snow, and I think about 37 today.
Yeah, it's about like here.
Yep.
Well, thank you for joining us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got the floor.
Okay, thank you. I'm Timothy Bowser, veterinarian from Soldotna, and I'm representing the Board of Veterinary Examiners here, basically, if there was any questions.
Nope, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. I think in about 1 minute we're going to roll the bill out, Tim.
Sounds good.
Well, that's the last of the public testimony. We're back to the committee.
If there's no discussion, your pleasure, I'll make it move the bill. So I'd move House Bill number 86-26-LS0421/A with individual recommendation and attached fiscal note.
And seeing no objection, the bill moves out of committee, and with that, we will adjourn.